Okay, how are you doing tonight? Good to see you. This is class number 4, our 4th time together, and I've entitled it Relationship Matters, Controlling Your Reactivity. Now remember, we're trying to grow a solid self, a solid but flexible self, so not too rigid, not too black and white, not so flexible that you don't have an opinion. There's a balance in there, and that's maturity. We're growing up, trying to balance complex realities, manage opposites. We want to be influenced by people and listen to them carefully, but not overly influenced so as to be people-pleasing and take on their shape. We don't want to be so rigid that we can't be influenced, but we don't want to be so flexible that we automatically take the shape of others, like Leonard Zelig, Woody Allen, that whoever he's around, he becomes. We don't want to do that. So we're all learning to grow up and differentiate. And each and every one of us begin in a family system. And think of that family system when children are growing up in that system as a primordial soup, a single cell, and each member in that system is learning to emerge out of this, grow up, differentiate, and establish a personal identity. And so when might it be in a family system that this differentiation process becomes more pronounced? What ages? Chaotic and pronounced. Teenage. Early teenage, middle teenage, extending into late teens, 17, 18. So young middle schoolers are beginning to differentiate from their parents, developing complex thinking ability. The brain is developing. They're no longer rigid, concrete thinkers. Now they're beginning to assign motives to their parents. Like, oh, I know why you said that. When they're little, before age 12, they're not thinking that way, right? They just think you're God, because you are. But 12, 13, 14, they're beginning to now have brain functionings where they're assigning motives and they're appraising the situation, but oftentimes they're incorrect, but they think they're so correct, right? So they're learning and growing up, becoming more responsible, hopefully, and they're differentiating, and the first stage of differentiation is I am not you. So they're opposing their parents, so to speak. They're not really rebelling, but they are differentiating. I am not you. So they look at their peers and see their status with their peers, and they're growing, and we're empowering, encouraging these wonderful people to grow up and think for themselves, even if it means not thinking exactly the way we think, right? Yes. Now we hope they embrace our values, but, you know, because our values are the right values, the most important values, right? We hope they would embrace, but they're all growing up and learning to think, develop, test out things, and we want to be loving and supportive and say, please be thoughtful and responsible, right? So, we're growing a solid self, then we're managing our emotions, and let's pick up there because some of you were appropriately distressed because I didn't get to this slide, right? So some of you came last week saying the one thing that I hoped we would talk about and discuss, we didn't get to. No fear. I always carry over so that you get the benefit. Now, let's think through this thoughtful question, which is thoughtful question number 2, because it's a carryover from last week, right? I simply said, when is it right or appropriate to share your emotions? And I know that I probably distressed some of you by saying one of the primary reasons that we share emotion as people, as human beings, is to naturally influence others. Now, I didn't say that that's every time, all the time. I'm simply saying it's a driving factor in human beings to share emotions to influence the other person to change their behaviors or get them to understand something. It's an influencing thing. So, ask yourself always these questions, because I'm just trying to balance out, as we will see a little bit more, emotions will tell us as much about ourselves many times, if not more, than about the actual situation. So if we say to somebody, "You caused me to feel this emotion," I'm only advocating that we stop and be thoughtful and balance out that way of thinking with another thought. I am experiencing this emotion. What's causing it is something inside of me. You might be the trigger. Does that make sense? The event is the trigger. So I'm not sure you're directly causing what I'm feeling. So as responsible people, then I want to balance it out with all of us to say, I am experiencing something, no doubt. It might be a more productive discussion if we leave out the word, "You are causing it." Because automatically something's going on with that statement. So, to balance it out, we should ask ourselves, what might be the purpose of sharing what you are feeling and experiencing with another person? Whether it be your spouse, whether it be your boss, whether it be a relative. At least ask yourself before you share, why am I sharing this emotion? It's just a nice self-confrontation. What is motivating me to share my emotion? Now just think through in business with me. Would it be your regular habit to go into your superior, whoever that might be, and say, "Let me just share with you what I am feeling"? Is that a normal occurrence? We have a no. What do you think? And why isn't it? Russell said it. They don't care. Go ahead.
Don't want to be perceived as weak. What is this guy doing?
That's a good thought. Don't want to be perceived as weak. I mean, okay. Thanks for sharing. It would be an odd kind of thing, wouldn't it? Give me some more reasons. Why wouldn't you do that? "Hey, superior, boss, I just need to tell you I am really angry."
Because the situation's escalated beyond that at that point, usually.
That's wonderfully said. The sharing of an emotion sometimes escalates the situation. Last year, just for fun, I got my concealed handgun license. Because I just wanted to, right? No, I'm not packing right now, so no worries. But certainly one understands one should never pull out a handgun or a weapon to de-escalate a situation. Right? The moment that is in play, it's escalating it. Well, many times the same with sharing emotions. Because we're going to see it in just a moment. One of the premises of sharing an emotion is that the other person can remain non-reactive and receive the sharing. Right? For it to be a successful transaction? You get that? What if the sharing of your emotion actually incites the other person to be more emotional? Then what's been accomplished? Nothing productively, except now I got two hula hoops totally vibrating. Neither of them having the ability to calm down. So, ask yourself at least, what do you want to happen as a result of disclosing this information? At least ask yourself. If you share what you're experiencing, what is it that you think in your mind you want to happen next? At least ask before you do that. Don't automatically think it's going to happen. Ask yourself. Then ask, can the other person find the value in this process? I wouldn't assume they will.
How can you assume they will or won't?
It depends on the nature of the relationship. You can test it out sometimes, even in friendships. Do you mind if I share with you what's going on inside of me? I would like to be able to talk about that. But how it's talked about then, if I use a you term, this is going to break down. They're going to have to really hold on to themselves to not personalize what I'm personalizing. So I think you might have to tease out and process, could we talk about what's going on right now? Would that be possible? The other person says, no, I don't find the value in that. Okay. I don't know. But we at least have to ask the question, does another person find the value in process? Now in therapy, many times it's normal that if I'm interacting with somebody, I'm there to help them and be very helpful. I'm a guest in their territory. Now they think they're on my territory, but I'm a guest in their living room, so to speak. It's a privilege for me to work with them and to be helpful to them. Sometimes if we're interacting and I notice that they've just experienced an emotion, I might let it go by for 2 or 3 minutes and I might return to when everybody's finished talking and I'll say, you know, just a moment ago, I want you to know that anytime we experience an emotion, it means that something matters to us. Did something matter to you a minute ago? Do you remember what it was? Did you experience an emotion? Can you tell me what triggered it? Now that's an invitation, right? I'm just inviting a process. I'd like to understand it. You seemed that something mattered to you. They teared up. That's okay. Do you remember what it was? And they'll probably immediately tear up again and they'll say, I think it was when this was said. And I'll say, thank you. That really helps me understand you. Help me know why this matters. Can you tell her? Can you go get Caitlin? Well, let's just do it at the break. But see if she has another wireless. Thanks. That's an invitation to process. But you notice what's happening is for people to share from within their hula hoop, I'm going to call that intimacy. I'm disclosing inside of me what's going on inside of me, and I'm not blaming you for it. I'm not even saying it's your fault or you're causing it. I'm only saying what I'm experiencing and what's very real in me. That's a moment of intimacy. I don't even need you to understand it for it to be intimate. It's intimate to me. You don't have to totally get it. I'm the one who's experiencing it. Once you realize I'm not blaming you, I'm not attributing to you blame or fault or causation, do you think you could relax more and just listen to me? Yes or no?
Yes.
Then what breaks down between married couples? Why does the process of sharing and intimacy break down? Okay, say more. Say more. I'm sorry, say that again.
A heightened sense of emotion.
Oh, I like that because this is where we're going to go in a minute to this diagram. Yes, there can be a heightened sense of emotionality, a heightened sense of physiology in the moment, and the hula hoops are vibrating. And then the whole process breaks down because they can't manage themselves around the emotional content of the conversation.
words that set people off.
Yes, there are trigger words, and that's going to be right here in this diagram, which we're going to get to in a moment. Trigger words are what I'm calling the brain's auto-appraiser. Do you remember RoboCop? And where was RoboCop filmed? Here in Dallas, yeah, Los Colinas. The original RoboCop. All right, so remember, RoboCop, when he opens his eyes, the computer comes on, and you're seeing through RoboCop's eyes, and he's processing data, and he's scanning, and it's adding up. Well, our brains are constantly scanning the environment, and we have some sensitive markers on our emotional filter, and it's scanning, looking for images, facial expressions, and it's reading and projecting, oh, that person's upset, oh. And it's looking, and so the brain does a shortcut because it has a storage data, and it does a quick trip. It doesn't process everything. It just auto-appraises. Now, it can misappraise, but it's auto-appraising and listening for sensitive trigger words, because then it's going to protect itself and go into a heightened alert. So when couples rehearse negative ways of relating, the auto-appraiser stores it, and right when somebody mentions a trigger word, the whole hula hoop goes into defense mode. Make sense? It's very common among people who matter to each other. Then you have to ask, does the other person have the tolerance, ability to participate in this process? If I turn this off, can you hear me?
Yep.
Good. Somebody said no? Okay, because it's bugging me going in and out. So I'll talk loudly, I'll face you, right? Does this person actually in real life have the ability to not absorb the vibrations, manage themselves around the emotional content that is taking place? So when I say controlling reactivity, what we want to learn is, in a family system, if y'all are all together for Christmas and Uncle Joe comes, and Uncle Joe's a character, and Uncle Joe can get everybody's hula hoop vibrating, can you remain in the room and not absorb the vibrations? Can you feel them, but not absorb them? So maturity is, can I be affected, because I'm human, without being infected? Yes, the answer is yes. We can learn to do that. Now, if I can feel the effect and know what I'm experiencing and can name it, I have a better chance to feel in control. I am currently experiencing something. I have to understand what's going on so I can have the best chance of self-control, because once I lose it, what might be true? The other person loses it. If the other person loses it, what happens next? All members of the family pick up the anxiety and start vibrating in their own ways. And low differentiated people, when they all gather, as one of my clients said, for a wedding, we know the police will be called. Because each trigger the other, and all hula hoops, and then there's a blow up, and then somebody has to call the police. They say, oh, when we get together, we know what's going to happen. Wow. Lovely time. I want to come to y'all's gathering. So when is it right to share emotions? When you can control and share from within your hula hoop and make known what's going on inside of you without blaming the other person, in a way that invites participation, not blames or distances. It's a moment of intimacy. But you really have to be thoughtful. Is the other person in a place where they can receive and hear it? You can't just spring it on a person. You have to at least invite participation and say, honey, do you mind if I share something with you? I'm not blaming you. It's something I'm experiencing. It's very real to me. Now, even if you do that, the other person could have an overpersonalization filter, and they, even when you say, I'm not faulting you, they could take it personally, right? Then you have to really hold on to yourself, because now they're triggered and you just wanted to share your emotions. Oh boy, here we go. Now they're vibrating and can't maintain it, and you have to maintain it. You can't just get frustrated and go, ah, this is stupid. Well, you can. And then the hula hoops blow apart and they have to reset. Try again. Any questions about this? Yeah.
So let's just assume that you are doing everything right. You're in your hula hoop.
Mm-hmm.
You're tolerating Uncle Joe's
character. Right.
But, I mean, in that scenario, you know, I may be able to control myself in my hula hoop, but that doesn't mean that I really want to have a relationship with Uncle Joe or like Uncle Joe necessarily.
Yes. That was brilliant. Uncle Mom, she said. What if it's Uncle Mom?
Somebody who
more permanent. Yeah. Okay. The question is, in my example about Uncle Joe is one thing because Uncle Joe is transient and he comes in. I don't mean he's homeless. I just mean he's coming in and he's coming. He may be. He's coming in, he's coming out of your life, and we can tolerate that and say, oh my gosh, we can just get through this evening. This will be fine. But when it's somebody a little more permanent, well, I would have to drill down on an individual time and say, there are many ways that I can strengthen you inside your hula hoop around a human being who overflows their hula hoop a little more often and sets you in motion. Right? Is that the gist of what you're trying to say? Somebody more permanent in our life. Then I'm going to have to work at depersonalizing Mom. So even the term mom is an emotional trigger. Mom's coming over. Now, I know mom's a sweet person, so I'm just using this. Then I'm going to have to say, instead of mom, let's say Betty. Why? Because it gives objectivity. Mom is an emotional term with emotional baggage and emotional history. Let's use separate language. Betty is coming over. Betty is a separate person from me. Yes, Betty's in her own hula hoop. Right. Then what challenges do I face? Betty overflows her boundaries and she walks in and she tries to correct everything in my house. Why did you do this? Why did you do this? This doesn't look good here. Oh my gosh, when did you get this? This doesn't fit. Betty corrects everything in my house and finds all the deficiencies, and that affects me. Okay, then I'm going to have to say, that is very challenging. What's it to you? Do you know if you try to feed an alligator a bloody chicken, it not only takes the chicken, but it could take your arm too, correct? Then we would say, that's just what alligators do. Right? Right? This is not a bunny rabbit. So I'm going to have to make you, I'm going to have to help you be more clinical. Mom is a clinical reality. Mom is autistic. When Mom Betty walks in, autistic people rock, look at lights, and that's just what they do. Right? Do we get mad at them? No. We say, oh, that's what autism is. Yes, in my example, yes. Now, if we think they shouldn't be doing that, we're mad. So I want to say, how long have you known Betty / Mom? All my life. Has Mom mostly been this way? Yes. Why would you think Mom is not going to be this way? I keep thinking Mom's going to show up and not be Mom. No, but Mom, this is the essence. So we're going to keep working at depersonalizing to stabilize the hula hoop, to not overflow and find ways to not overpersonalize what can be very personal behavior, even annoying behavior. I'm still going to come up with terms that describe that so that we can create emotional separateness and psychological freedom. Make sense? We got to drill down, though, and spend a whole time de-emotionalizing. Why? Because our goal is freedom. Freedom in the hula hoop so we can deal with this, accept it, try to respond to it the best way you can, but you got to be careful, right? If you respond out of irritation to this person, you usually get irritation back. Right? Because I'm irritated. I don't like what you're doing. It's out of irritation that I'm going to talk to you. Usually not very productive. People don't change because you're irritated. Wait a minute. Sometimes they do. But it's limited. Isn't it? Okay. Okay. Stay with me.
Question.
When
do we have any responsibility for anyone else's emotions? Or do we never?
When do we have responsibility? Well, that's a tricky word, and we'd have to really think through. I don't know that responsibility is exactly the right word, and you said that. I think it's always good for each of us to say, how might I be contributing to this interaction and the emotions that this person is experiencing? Contributing, inadvertently or overtly? I think it's a healthy question. If every time I use certain words, it irritates and causes pain, panic, hurt in this person, I might change my words if I wish this to be a constructive interaction. So it's always good to say, how might I inadvertently be contributing to what this person might be experiencing? I think it's a very healthy self-confrontation. But you're right, I'm really iffy on the word responsible. It's just like with, let's take alcoholism. I'm not responsible for this person's response or their drinking problem. I may be responsible for how I inadvertently contribute by trying to help them. Did you get that? I may be a contributor to the cycle by my good attempts to get them to not drink. So I'm going to have to learn that and change my ways because my ways are getting in the way. I'm not causing them to drink, but I might be contributing to a larger syndrome that's going on. It's a healthy question that we should ask ourselves. So let's look at this. Responsible sharing. Take responsibility for your own emotions. Don't blame them on everybody else. It's usually not a great conversation starter. You are causing me, FYI, to feel really upset. Oh, where do you want this to go? Resist the temptation to blame others for what you're feeling. Be careful of the you word. Do we want this interaction to be constructive, or do you just want to blame shift and be mad? You can do that. It's not very constructive. Share from inside your hula hoop so as to be known. I'm experiencing this. This is real to me. I'm feeling it. I'll share a little bit more about that in a minute. Your emotions will tell you a lot about your own life. First and foremost, allow your emotions to say something about you. Because remember, as we'll see in a moment, the auto-appraiser from the family that you grew up in and from life's interactions has sensitive sensors on it that may not match others. They're your sensitivities. They are real to you. These sensors, which are real, produce real emotions. You can learn about these in your life and say, and learn, I am very sensitive to feeling certain emotions in these kinds of settings, in these kinds of interactions. That's a wonderful knowledge to have, your own sensitivities. It promotes healthy living and relationships. Your emotions tell us a lot about our own life, and share your life with others without taking them emotionally hostage. It's amazing that people respond well if presented well, what we're experiencing. I get the privilege in my office of all the time seeing that take place. Turning negative interactions into very constructive ones where people feel connected without blaming each other, and they're just sharing what they're experiencing without blame. Just to be understood. It's amazing that people will make alterations when they're not having a gun held to their head by the other person. They'll make adjustments when given choices. Does that make sense? It's just harder to do in marriage. Can you tell me why that is? Yes. Which again, we're going to see in this diagram. Thank you. We could come back to that situation. Why? Because in this cycle that I'm going to describe, later on there's heightened recall of the original sensors. A person holds on to them, narrows their focus, and has a hard time letting them go. So they come up again and again later with heightened recall and selective memory bias. You said this. Wow. Okay?
If someone has a gun on me, I see an end to that situation.
Right.
But in a marriage situation, you constantly come back to situations because you stay married to that person.
Yes, it's what married couples tend to do, but in therapy we can learn not to do it. Because if a person is coming back constantly, bringing up a situation, they must have an ultimate goal and a reason for doing so. However, it's ineffective. So I'm going to honor what they're trying to do, what their goal is, but we have to point out their means for doing so is actually producing the opposite from what their heart really wants. Now that's all of us. It's part of being human. But we can learn to do this differently. We can. Now I like this. This is one of my favorite sayings. I coach my people. In order for a problem to be or have a chance to be the problem, your number one goal is don't you become the problem. Now, can you parse that for me? What am I trying to describe by that sentence? Tell me an issue that you're trying to bring up at work, in a trial, a prosecutor, in a business meeting, in a marriage. Give me an issue. In order for an issue to have a chance to be the issue, give me an issue.
An agreement was made.
An agreement was made?
Yeah.
Yes.
We disagree on what the agreement actually was.
All right, so the issue is we have a document of an agreement. We want to focus on this disagreement about the agreement, correct? This is what we want our focus to be. Now, in order for that to be the focus, don't let what happen? That's right. Don't let your response to the disagreement agreement of the document, don't let your response become the issue of the meeting. Make sense? But give me human nature of why is it human nature? Why is this counterintuitive? Why do we package the importance of the issue with our emotional response?
We make it
I'm sorry, what?
We, make it
we can make it personal.
We're pressing our agenda.
And we believe that the issue and our emotional intensity have a right to line up. So our upsetness is trying to say, this is an important issue. But it gets in the way many times. If the issue is so important, can't we allow the issue to become important?
Yeah.
Because what people walk away with is your upsetness. Have you ever been in a jury in a trial? Have you ever had a prosecutor get very emotional while he's presenting evidence? I have. I assure you, in the jury room later, the jury took a step back when the prosecutor got over emotional about proving his point, he or she. If the data is the data, we want the data to convict. No, the prosecutor got real emotional and made a big emotional issue, and everybody said, we don't trust that guy. So the emotional response became the focus rather than the issue. But we think, no, I have a right to combine these, and you will tolerate it and see your way through and hear my issue. What if the other person starts to flood with emotions and they get lost in your response? Is it productive or counterproductive? It's counterproductive. Right? So, in order for an issue, here's another way to say it, to have a chance to become the issue, don't let your emotional response to the issue become the issue. What's the real issue? Is it your emotional response or is it the issue? I assure you, it's the issue. Then talk calmly. Control your fear. Control your fears, threats, and your insecurities. Discipline yourself. Take a walk around the block. Rehearse how you want to present the issue. Practice. Because the issue is so important, you don't want your spouse or this person to miss the issue, then make the issue and let it sit there. If you can't get a response based on the issue, you're not going to get it based on your emotions. Same in parenting. If you need a big emotional response to correct children, a big one, you're going to need a bigger one later.
It's hard to maintain attention and focus when you're getting in this heightened sensitivity in the situation.
Yes, it is.
It's like you're shutting doors already. You're slamming them and trying to get away from the situation.
Yes.
That you're stuck in.
That's why I'm saying we're going to learn to become Navy SEALs who practice under stress and high anxiety to maintain their cognitive function so they can win the battle, do the right thing, and survive.
Is this like 101, and how many semesters are there?
This is the rest of your life if you're married. Every day is a chance to practice and be thankful that you're learning to be a Navy SEAL. And some things, some issues, will just grab you, throw you on the floor, you'll become a crazy person. Just laugh later and go, whoa, that one got me. I'm going to be better prepared next time. We're not perfect. I'm not looking for perfection. Just growth. And I say, what do you want the focus to be? Are you trying to find a solution, or do you simply want to make it personal? If you want to do that, you can do that. Plant a flag on top of a hilltop and impale yourself on it. Go after it. But at the end, what do you really want? You're trying to find an effective solution. Your partner will be immensely appreciative if you can maintain self-control under an intense situation to make the issue the issue. They'll thank you. There is the problem, remember, but there again, there is our response to the problem. Always remember that. In life, life is life. We are not victims. Nobody made you do anything. Nobody caused you to do anything. There was an issue in life, whatever it is, and there is my response. I'm not responsible for what happens this way to me directly. I am responsible for how and I respond to it. I am. If it gets me, throws me to the ground, I need to learn. Have ownership. Say, that hit me in a weak spot. I was flooded. I didn't know what else to do. I screamed. I yelled. I'm so sorry. I need to regain control, which we're going to see in a moment, about slow to return to baseline, calm myself, slow down my heart rate, return to baseline, soothe and comfort, rather than keep agitated and rehearsing the negative scenario in my head. I can learn. So our emotional response does not necessarily change reality. Do you know that? You can yell at all the cars on LBJ, doesn't change it. Have you figured that out? Do you know you could yell at your TV last night when Tony Romo came back into the game? You can yell, keep Whedon in the game. You know what's not going to make any difference? It's going to be what it's going to be. Have you figured that out?
No.
No? I'm not busting your bubble. They have been listening, haven't they? When you've been yelling. Go ahead.
Okay. What if you go, time out.
Right.
And you recognize that you're just out of control vibrating.
Yes.
And you've got to go for a walk or you've got to get
okay.
away.
Yes.
What if somebody comes after you?
You do the best you can because the other person's having a hard time managing themselves. The thing probably not to do is to turn to them and say, you get back. Okay. It usually doesn't work. We do the best we can.
So you just kind of say, hey.
Sometimes I tell people, just sit on the floor and look at your feet, and no matter what happens, close your eyes, look at your feet, and count to 20, and say, this is the best I can do. I don't know what else to do. This person's going off, yelling, screaming, hollering. I need to sit and wait. And even they say, but if I do that, they're going to yell more. Okay, I have no solution. If you stand up, they're going to yell. If you get in their face and say, please stop, they're going to yell. If you sit on the floor, they're going to yell. So just do the best you can and wait till things return to baseline. We'll be okay. If it keeps up, we call the police. Okay? If our emotional response does not bring about change, if our emotional response does bring about some sort of change, consider this. Having the emotional response in order to sustain the change that's been created. Look, if you got an emotional response and corrected reality in some way by yelling at people, guess what you're going to have to do next time? You're going to have to yell, then yell louder, then yell, then power posture. I think we've come a ways in our society that abusive coaching styles are not effective. Some would argue that we have a right to beat people down and threaten kids or whatever to get the best out of them. I don't believe that. I don't believe it. I don't think parenting is using authority and power and yelling and loudness to get everybody to listen and shut up. I'm saying sometimes, yes, I get effective presentation requires some firm presence, but don't count on power to ultimately win the day. We got to think bigger than that. Okay, one last thing. Resist the temptation to say, this shouldn't be happening. Why would I tell you never say that? Because it's happening. Don't ever say, this shouldn't be happening. My friend, it should be happening. Why? Because it's happening. Let's try to work with what exactly is happening. So say this. You know what? Everything is exactly as it should be in this moment for things to be exactly the way they are. Yes. Whether I like it or not. What is necessary for it to be this way is exactly present. Yes. Well, then let's construct an effective response. But don't live a life of protest. This shouldn't be this way. Yes, it should. It is this way. What response can we have to it in freedom? Lastly, and we'll take a break. You know what? Let's take a break and let's pick up here right when we come back. Anger the emotion, right? Let's talk about anger. Take a 10-minute break, get some coffee, some cookies, and stay in your hula hoop. Okay, let's think through this with me, okay? I think we've made it a little bit warmer because I know it's a little cold in here for you guys. Now, remember last week when I shared with you how my own reality kind of was generating emotions, but it didn't match reality? Remember I shared a little incident? Well, let me share with you another one. This is a letter that I wrote a couple of people that I'm helping, and I'm actually helping them through FaceTime. They live in another city, and we FaceTime together an hour or so a week. And so after a particular interaction back in April, I wrote this letter. Dear Tom and Mary, not their real names, I really don't have enough words to express to you my own sorrow, sadness, and deep regret, and a good deal of shame, worthily earned, I might add, over my words to you during our last session. No excuses, really, just deep sorrow and regret. My words came from a place in me that I can best describe as a place of frustration. In therapy, when this happens, it's always the therapist's fault, as it certainly was on this occasion. There's a delicate balance between caring and having too much invested, and I believe I had way too much invested in leading you both in a direction and to an outcome that I thought I should lead you to. Of course, you're on your own journey, not mine, and I had no business trying to force you to go in my direction, even if I thought it was for your own good. All totally my fault. I really hate hurting you, and I dislike getting in the way of a good direction that I wish for both of you. I simply became a part of the problem and not the solution. I live my life desiring to be helpful to those that I care about, but in this instance, in this interaction, I think I was more of the problem in a major way. Please accept my deepest heartfelt apologies, really and truly. I hurt and have sorrow over this every time I think about it. Thinking of you both, and thanks for your understanding, sincerely. Would you say that letter was heartfelt?
Yes.
Would you think that that is sincere of my love and care from me to them? Do you believe I have ownership, personal ownership, and some degree of examination of my own heart and my own life? When we communicated the next time, they both said, "We got your letter. We have no idea what you're talking about." I said, "Really? No, really. We came away from our session feeling really good about it, about your frankness and your honesty to us. Really? Really? And by the way, what is it that you are referring to?" I said, "You're kidding me." They said, "No, we both talked about it. We can't figure out what you said to us that you're feeling all this deep sorrow and regret and taking ownership of." And I said, "It burns in my memory. Well, what is it?" "Well, when I said, for all your spirituality, your marriage is a mockery." They said, "Oh, we both came away and said, he's right." "So that didn't offend you?" "Oh no, we appreciate your frankness and honesty, and that's why we want to see you." "Oh." "Thank you." Now, I still believe my letter was okay for me to send. I do think it came out of a place of frustration in me that I would rather not communicate to those I care about and those that hire me to help them, because I think my frustration, my personal frustration, can get in the way. And I did realize I'm trying to lead them to the well to drink, and I'm frustrated. That was my learning point. Right? They didn't experience that at all. They experienced it as care. Now, I learned something. They learned something. I actually had a session today. They brought it up on their own, because this happened back in March. And they said, "You still worried about that?" I said, "No." They said, "Well, don't be, because we've talked about it a couple of times, and that was a really good session." I said, "Okay, I got it." Now, can you see how realities can be felt and experienced, yet are so uniquely different? I carried that inside of me, this contrition, for at least 5 to 7 days, wrote this letter, I took ownership. They said, "Thanks very much, we really appreciate it, but I don't know what we're talking about here." So very sweet. This is why I say our emotions tell us a lot but not necessarily about reality or what the other person is experiencing. We just had a relationship where we could check it out. We both benefited. It was handled well. Okay? Now let's think about anger just for a moment, the emotion. I want you to see that the emotion of anger is usually based on a narrative, that is a story, that is a filter, a perspective based in truth, justice, right, wrong, what should be, what ought to be. Does that make sense? If you get angry over the traffic, you may think to yourself, they just finished this freeway, this shouldn't be crowded. Got that? What's it based on?
You're in a hurry.
What should be? What ought to be? Make sense? So anytime we have a difference between what our mind says, this shouldn't be happening. The number one emotion is going to be frustration / anger. Because your brain tells you the ideal is this. I'm getting this, the gap between the two, we call anger. So what we're working with is people in my office who have an over-idealized, perfectionist way of living in an imperfect world. They're angry all the time. Why? Yes. Their inner map has an ideal, but they're dealing with external reality and they're always trying to get external reality to map their inner ideal world. They're constantly frustrated, leading to constant anger. So I want you to think of anger also as the emotion experienced as the result of a blocked goal. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We need angry. Anger. We need it. Thank you. Thanks, honey. I just didn't know. Thanks. I turned it on this one. Thank you. Is everybody getting angry because it's not matching? Yes. Natasha didn't even notice. That's good. If I'm trying to get here and I'm here and I hit 7 red lights, what's the emotion I'm likely to experience? Now, I didn't say what would I say. Anger. Why? Yeah, I'm trying to get over there and I get 7 red lights and a stalled car. And I'm under a time constraint. I told him I'd be there at 3. It's 10 till. I'm frustrated because I have a blocked goal. Now, what if you're trying to have a conversation with a significant person in your life and you're trying to be as clear as you can, explain yourself, and they don't get it? And you keep looking at them saying, do you understand? Do you get it? And they say, stop it. They say, no. Do you grow more patient and go, oh my gosh, something's breaking down here. Let me think through a different way to approach this because obviously this isn't working. Is that what we normally do? Regroup and go, No, we get frustrated. We get angry because it's perfectly clear to us. What is wrong with you? We're thinking. Don't you get it? Oh my gosh. I'm angry. So I want you to see anger is based in truth and justice. This shouldn't be happening. Oh my friend, it is. Please don't be frustrated and angry. I paid good money. I didn't pay to wait in line at this restaurant. But you're waiting in line in this restaurant. Right? So what are we going to do? Just be angry? Yeah. But anger doesn't change reality. If it does, you're going to have to keep being angry. The world's not going to change because you are personally frustrated and angry. They might for a little while, and then after a while they go, oh yeah, well, you know how Dad is. You know how Uncle Joe is. You know how Mom is. They write you off. Yeah, we expected that person to get angry. What is it? It's an emotion ignited, get this, I always tell my clients, as a result of felt powerlessness. Anger is a compensating, powerful emotion, usually to cover up feelings of powerlessness. Fears, threats, insecurities. It's a compensating emotion. If you're angry, here's the top side of the coin. I have anger. I want to help look at the other side of the coin, which is powerlessness, fear, threat, insecurity, smallness, because this is a compensation. You know when a little cat or a little kitten power postures and dances and puffs their fur up? Have you ever seen that? That's a power posturing to ward off and to blow themselves up. That's what human beings do. They blow themselves up and they power posture. Why? Because they're so powerful? Why? That's right. The bigger the anger, the bigger the power. The other side of the coin is there's an inverse correlation to how much powerlessness they feel in their life and out of control. They have to compensate by being in control and power posturing. So beneath big anger, especially rage, is shame. Always. You want to see rage? Shame a person. Castrate them. Put them down. Attack them at the core of their being and tell them they're worth nothing. Over and over. You'll see rage. Rage is a compensation for extreme shame, powerlessness, made to feel bad. It's very real. You hit that sensitive marker in that person, boom, it ignites. It's an emotion, lastly, that represents inhibited grieving, sadness, and loss. This is a person who can't be sad because beneath the anger, there's inhibited grieving. If you get them in touch with that, they're afraid to grieve. They're afraid to cry 1,000 years. They're afraid for all the hurt, sorrow, disappointment in their life. They have to keep away from it by being angry. Anger can represent inhibited grieving, sadness, loss, disappointment. You just have to get through that anger to the other side, if they're willing. But it's a defense mechanism. Yeah.
So, are there people that are angry inside, but they just don't show it?
Yes.
And they turn around and they use it.
Sure.
To humiliate, manipulate.
Sure.
Shame people.
And sure.
And the people that they do that to, then in turn, they feel rage and anger.
That is correct. So when we say somebody is, because some people, in my office when I'm working with them, they say, I don't understand this phrase. If somebody is passively aggressive, do you get the concept? Openly aggressive is open aggression. Right? Passive aggression is, I'm angry on the inside, but I'm smiling. And I'm just not going to show for the appointment. It's a passive way of compensating and getting even in a sideways manner, all the way smiling. Because then you're really fooled. It's like, wait a minute, I don't understand what just happened.
But what's the difference between that and then not getting angry when you get a person that's raging? I mean, because you're human.
Well, the difference is, good question. The difference is, I can have the ability to be affected and not get angry when the other person's raging, right? I have the ability, I can learn the ability as a therapist. I may be tempted to absorb it all and ruminate on it later, and it comes out sideways by the rumination and the tapes and the rehearsal that I feel put down as a result of this interaction. If I can learn to constructively deal with that, I do not have to act it out denying that it's there. Make sense?
Well, yes. Have we gotten to that part of it yet? I mean,
don't be getting it here.
So, Billy, can I ask just one more question?
Sure, you can.
So, what I think what I'm saying is that this person that's passive aggressive,
yes,
is they take control of the situation by not giving any control to the other person to deal with the. The passive aggressive person doesn't show anger. And so because of that, the other person really doesn't know how to deal with the situation.
No, but over time they're going to learn how to deal with the situation, because at first it does a number on your mental map. So you don't ask the person, are you angry?
Oh, no.
Oh, thank you. That's exactly what's going to say.
Oh, no.
But if you're validation dependent, as we talked about in our second talk, if I'm validation dependent and I ask you, are you angry, and you tell me no, and I need your validation to be accurate, then my mind is going to get manipulated. I can't think for myself. Over time, I'm going to learn, wait a minute, something more is going on, even if I ask them and they deny it. Right? So you're not crazy. But if you keep pursuing them, saying, are you really feeling angry? I think you're angry. No, I'm not angry. Are you really feeling angry? I think you're angry. No, I'm not angry. Are you really feeling... Okay, stop. That's a battle for validation. If you really believe it, go for a walk. Don't go back to them. They already told you no. No, I need you to own it. Oh my goodness. You need them to own it? Oh, we just might as well tie a rope around your waist and around their waist. You don't need anybody to own anything. You can think for yourself. You'd like them to own it. I ask my clients all the time, are you doing okay? Yeah, I'm doing okay. 3 weeks later, they come in, well, that's something I need to tell you. Oh? Yeah, I didn't disclose, but I'm doing some really bad stuff out here. Oh, it only took you 12 weeks to tell me? Do you see what I mean? I have to take people at face value, even if I think something more is going on. I can ask them. I don't need to follow them out of my office going, I think I'm right. Do you think I'm right? I think I'm right. Do you think I'm right? I need you to acknowledge that I'm mostly right. They're going to look right at me and go, no, you're not right. No, I'm beyond that. You do this enough, you're going to go, you know, I think more is going on. And if I ask them, they're going to tell me no. I just always wait. So that's the tricky part. You're right. All right, so hang with this. Effective interpersonal relations, this whole concept, are enormously benefited by a stable sense of self inside a person and a capacity for spontaneity in emotional expression. Successful relationships require a capacity to regulate emotions, self-regulate, in appropriate ways. Look at that again. Successful relationships, especially marriage, require a capacity for a living organism to regulate its own emotions in appropriate ways, to control impulsive behavior. It means impulsive, meaning urges, reactivity, impulses, and to tolerate stimuli that produce discomfort. Maturing people learn to tolerate discomfort for a greater goal. Let me say that again. Maturing people learn to tolerate temporary discomfort in a relational interaction for the sake of a larger goal. If they can't, they're driven by the moment of the urgency and discomfort of the interaction, driven by it. This will not be a very successful interaction when that happens. Does that make sense? You okay with that? Do you get it? Maturing people are willing to experience discomfort, take a hit between the eyes, tolerate, manage themselves for the sake of a greater goal of a successful interaction. If it's eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, the world will go blind. What Gandhi said? The eye for an eye, the world will go blind. Just because your partner was reactive to you, take a hit. Feel some injustice. Anchor to a larger goal, which is next week. Find the value. This is what successful people do. An unregulated living organism, a living organism that cannot regulate itself by nature, is invasive. Can you tell me what that statement means? Take Hitler. What does it mean? It is. It's hyperbole. A living organism that cannot regulate itself will cross your border and attack you. Do you understand that? Ebola. So this is what human beings do. Successful, productive relationships require these four abilities. The ability to inhibit inappropriate behavior when you have strong emotions. Successful relationships require this. You must do this at work or you will get fired. You must do this. But in marriage, we let ourselves off the hook. We say, I don't have to do that. You can't leave me. Which brings about worse behavior. Did you know that? I'll be with you no matter what, no matter what you do. That usually begets worse behavior. Now, I'm not saying walk around threatening to leave somebody to get good behavior. I'm simply saying in a relationship system where one knows the other will never leave, that person usually has bad behavior. You're not going to leave me? I'll just say what I want, produce emotions, and vent them. You got to put up with them because then you're never going to leave. You're never going to do anything. I know that for a fact. Oh, so it brings out the worst in people. Yes. Successful relationships self-regulate physiological arousal associated with the emotional effect. They have the ability to refocus the attention even when strong emotions are present and organize themselves in the service of a larger goal. That's what it takes. So here's the diagram. I know you can't see it in the back very well. We have an auto appraiser, which we're constantly scanning, and from your own family, maybe you have certain stimuli that you're sensitive to. I respect that. I always want to respect that. That each of us may be sensitive to certain triggers. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I want to respect and understand that about you because I care about you. So I want to understand your auto-appraisal, what kicks in your fears, threats, insecurities. Because it's part of being you. Now, this auto-appraiser may produce in some people a high sensitivity to emotional arousal. Can you just tell me what that phrase means? Think about it. Quickly, because it's a high sensitivity to an emotional stimulus. A sensitivity that maybe I wouldn't have, but you have. Maybe you grew up and people were trying to control you and impose their authority on you. And any time now in present life, you feel somebody imposing authority and telling you what to do, you have a high sensitivity and a quick emotional arousal. Does that make sense? You get it? But that's okay to have that in life. We have to understand it. Now, when you heard my letter, because that's my second example that I've given you. I gave you another example of me going to graduate class and feeling like I had upset the class when I really hadn't. Remember that? What might I be sensitive to in those two letters? Yes. It's my own sensitivity, if you understood me, growing up, the presence of my family, presence of my father, my mom, I'm the third born, I'm the only son. My number one goal to survive was to be perfect, make straight A's, not get in trouble, never be out of line, be good to survive the system, and get out and grow, and escape in my booster rocket, out of the orbit. I never wanted to color outside the line for many good reasons. Never. Never, never make a mistake in performance. Always do good. But of course, in learning to be compliant, I have a high sensitivity to what I perceive how I might offend others, and you're not even thinking that. I am. I have a high arousal and I have a shame sensitivity. I feel very visible to myself if and when I make what I believe is a mistake in front of myself and in front of you, to where I seem very visible to myself. You might not even be aware of it. But then later, I will have a shame spiral, an intense darkness for a day or two till I work my way out of it, where I have intense darkness and pain and beating myself up over something that you observing me go through, and you say, I don't understand what's producing this in you. And if I describe what I describe, you say, none of us has experienced that. I did. It's my sensitivity for many good reasons, many good ones. I'm always working at it in my life. Always. I'm very sensitive, trying to be stronger all the time. I have a high emotional arousal intensity, which produces a physiological response. I feel it in my body. It can produce an emotional flooding. Emotional flooding is when your heart rate goes above 100. And any person's heart rate who goes above 100 cannot access the neocortex thinking process in their brain. We can lose as many as 30 IQ points when your heart rate goes over 100, and you will be functionally mentally retarded. So when you're in a high intensity interaction, your heart rate and physiology and blood is pumping, adrenaline is flowing, and you're trying to have a fight, trust me, you will say crazy things. Crazy. You may act crazy. Because your thinking part of your brain cannot be accessed. So when you tell people in my office, calm down, does that work? No, it makes people more irritated. Okay? I'm just saying. Once we hit emotional flooding and high arousal, guess what happens to the thinking portion and the base part of our brain? You can't access your critical thinking. You cannot. Now, if we practice, you can learn to become a Navy SEAL, be under stress, and think clearly. You know, that might be me. I hope it isn't. I'll let it go. No, it's not. What happens when the blood flow is inhibited to the front part of the brain? It activates the fight or flight mechanism, and the attention and focus for the emotional stimuli narrows and becomes more intense.
Well, that was kind of what my question was before. I mean, once you kind of get you have someone on the other side, whether it's
right.
Yes? You know, and they're coming at you
Yes.
And so then they have some things that trigger the stress hormones.
Yes.
And adrenaline in your own body.
Yes.
On one hand, it might be easy to say, you know, stay calm. You know, I don't think that, but your body's doing something else differently.
Yes. Then, yes, with practice, all I'm saying, yes, to all. Our first goal, then, is to try our best to lower the physiology. Breathe. Close your eyes. Breathe. Look down at the floor. Distract. Try to be there. Try to keep it outside of your hula hoop. Imagine yourself in a mason jar. You're inside the mason jar. The other person's outside screaming at you. Try your best. What we say is, if you can't manage the emotion because the physiology is high, you with me? At least do your best to manage your behavior. Do your best. Do your best. We all get to practice. So whatever you lose it in this interaction, you can always chronicle, journal, make a note, what triggered you, and we can practice and learn and do better the next time. Life's a long journey. We can all breathe and go, wow, that one got me. Whew. Now, what happens next is the stimuli becomes more closely attuned to that produced the original intensity and physiology. It becomes more focused, and we begin to get into a refractory state and have distorted thinking. Now our thinking mechanism isn't thinking clearly, and the stimuli is more focused on, you said this, and we can't get off of it. Okay? There's heightened emotion, and now I have a slow return to baseline. I'm spiking, right? Now, can you see how professional athletes like football players handle marital conflict? Yes. Should we be surprised at the recent focus on family disturbance? We are training and teaching these guys to hit others, have overt aggression, celebrate aggression, have adrenaline pumping, take the biggest hits, deliver the biggest hits, pump themselves up, and then when they get into an interaction with somebody they love, I don't know that anybody's trained them how not to escalate and how to return to baseline, because they've been championed to go out with aggression and have greater aggression. So this is a real learning thing. So if they have a slow return to baseline, we've increased their vulnerability. They can't come down. So if we say, go for a walk, what I got to teach my clients is, if and when you go for a walk to return to baseline, don't negatively rehearse what you just went through. People say, well, I went for a walk and I came back madder than when I left. Well, what were you doing? I was replaying the conversation over and over and over and over. Okay, that's not very productive. Can we get out of the head and the rehearsal and the powerlessness feelings and the hurt and just say, okay, the sun is shining, let me breathe, let me go for a walk. We've got to return to baseline and get our body back in control the best way we can. Now, the more we practice this, the more we can learn that if it escalates, I can bring it down. I've sat in sessions in my office where people that I love and care about have drawn me into the interaction where I've become triggered, and I'm in there yelling with them. And I realize, wait a minute, I'm the therapist. That would be me. So then I sit and I go, okay, I can feel my heart rate racing. I can feel all the energy. And I quiet myself and calm myself, watch the tone of my voice, return to baseline, and we all sit there and look at each other, and I go, so what just happened? And they go, I said, I think I'm just in your living room and we're all experiencing this together. Should I just move in with you guys? And we all laugh. okay, could we go through this again? I think I got caught up in that. Everybody's okay? Because we're learning how to do this. Once there's a slow return to baseline, there's a heightened recall, and now I have selective memory bias. I'm only remembering the stimuli that's negative. I'm not remembering other things. And I have heightened recall. I can say word for word what you said. Right? Burned in my memory. Accurate thinking decreases. Biased interpretations. I misremember. I create a new story, a fantasy, a projection, because I have heightened recall, selective memory bias, slow return to baseline, which then goes into the auto appraiser, which increases high sensitivity, emotional arousal, and the whole cycle now repeats. I'm practicing a bad golf swing and getting a better bad golf swing. I'm practicing a bad emotional response and I'm learning the pattern. Did you know? I know we got to quit. Did you know that that the cathartic model that one day you learned, that catharsis means a cleansing, that if you cathartically express all of your emotions because you just need to get them out, you with me? Did you ever learn that? That's healthy? Do you know research shows the more you cathartically express, you're rehearsing that response and getting better at it, and you'll do it more and more and more and more, and it's not producing anything. You're actually rigidifying the response and cathartically expressing it more. You're not solving it, you're rehearsing it badly. Catharsis with emotions does not cure the emotion. It rehearses it, and you'll do it quicker next time. That's what research shows. Solidly research-based. A cathartic model. I need to express this and get it out. You'll do it quicker the next time. You'll let yourself off the hook. You're just learning a bad pattern, saying, I feel better now. You may feel better now in that moment. What do others feel? That's right. And next time, I believe that there's a drop-off with this, because once the arousal goes down, what are you likely to feel? Once you return to baseline, shame, defeated, embarrassment, powerlessness, sadness, sorrow. So we have to break this cycle up. I don't fault anybody for this. I understand this. Once we're caught up in it, it slams us to the ground. We become crazy people. I know how this can happen. I've experienced it. It's not shaming. What's sad is when it grabs us, controls us, and we're caught in it. It produces sadness, hurts relationships and people we love. We can learn a different way because this was learned. Don't fault anybody for this. Okay. Now,
Billy,
we're going to... Yeah, please. Please.
You just gave us an example of someone that is, you know, highly sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
How about the person that has low sensitivity?
Oh, I love that. I would say we're going to pick up with that next week because we're over time. But that's a great question. This is a high sensitivity. I want to think our way through what might appear to be low sensitivity. Okay? What I'm willing to postulate is low sensitivity is actually a mask for oversensitivity and can't allow themselves near the feeling because they're too sensitive to the feeling, so they mask it by not being sensitive at all. It's an opposite polarized effect where this one feels, wears their emotions on their sleeve. So it's not that the other person isn't having an emotion. They can't let themselves experience the emotion because they're afraid it's going to overtake them. Make sense?
Yeah.
They appear not to feel emotion I think their capacity to feel is pushing it way back because they're afraid and concerned it will overtake them. This person, it does overtake them.
If they're pushing it back down, are they still going to go through the same?
No. Okay. But when they do feel it, they're likely to be swept away by this, and that's the one thing they don't want to happen.
Because they want to feel in control.
Yes. And control's not a bad word, people. Controlling others is. Self-control is appropriate, but it can become too rigid to block out the appropriate emotion. It's okay to feel something, but they think it's not okay to feel something. Okay, you okay? One last comment. Because I'm sensitive.
Emoting, you know, going cathartically emoting. Is there anything you can say or do, like you take a walk? Or...
I'm happy to take a walk. Now let's go through this again.
You're trying to walk right now.
So you stop, drop, and roll.
Yeah.
Is there anything you can do for the other side, a buzzword or an expression, to start to mitigate or diffuse the...
Look, I don't know. Cooperation attempts, when I hold my little finger up, it means we're going to take a time out and this is a signal for you to control yourself. Oh, okay. This very predication of I'm going to do something to help soothe you. Look, all that's going to break down. I don't know. If it's achievable for you, you find that out. It's achievable for you. But usually the attempt to hold a finger up to say I'm attempting to soothe you is actually an attempt to soothe myself and use the other person. Honey, now we're both going to agree when we're rational and in our head that when I do this, it means we are going to take a time out. Now, what does that mean? Yes, when I do this, it means you stop. Okay. So I don't know. You all can explore it. I just know under extreme stress and duration and in this, anything you do might not be adequate. The other person is going to live it out. I don't want to say it defeatist. What I can do, the best I can do, is manage me and be a calming presence in the other person. They can learn to regulate themselves if I'm calm. If I stay near and dear while they're acting out and flying around the room and acting crazy, and I say, I get it, I'm okay, I get it, I understand, yes, that matters to me, I don't blame you, that's reasonable, I hear you. They might land after a while and go, okay, I'm back. Great. I'm glad you came down, honey. I've been waiting. I'm still here. No, I do it too. Okay. Having fun? All right, we'll pick up with this next week. Bring all your questions because I want you to feel helped. See you.